We want to welcome you here, St. Mary's Church in West Harlem. This is a historic church. It's been around since the early 1800s. As a matter of fact, black parishioners were here in this church. And of course, we are in what Columbia University hopes will be its imperialist territory of expansion for its university from 125th to 133rd, from 12th Avenue all the way over to Broadway and beyond. $6 billion worth of expansion to be built over a 50-year period. That's half a century. So you know Columbia University is really, really stoking the fires for a future that will not include Harlem as we see it today. And part of what we're going to be talking about today is wars against Africa and African people worldwide. And of course, we're going to start and talk about what's happening here in Harlem. Well, this is an International Day of Action Against Imperialist Wars Against Africa and African People. This is a day of teaching, resistance in a number of cities across the globe. And we'll talk about that later on once I get my notes together. And it was called by the Black Is Back Coalition, which is a national coalition of black organizations, black supporters. One of the main members or backers of Black Is Back is, of course, Black Agenda Report. And we're very happy today to have with us the executive editor of Black Agenda Report, Glenn Ford. He's going to start the program off. And he is going to give us a very general overview and very specifics of the International Day of Action Against Imperialist Wars Against Africa and African People Worldwide. And he will be followed by Professor William Sales, who is at Seton Hall University. And let me acknowledge some of our guests who have arrived, our guest speakers. Milton Amamadi, who is the publisher and executive editor of the Black Star News, is here with us, and we really look forward to hearing from him to talk about ethnic cleansing in Libya and the war crimes of NATO. We also have Carlito, no last name is needed, Rivera, for this activist who's been around for so many years, and he's going to talk about the solidarity between blacks and Latinos, specifically Puerto Ricans. He's a former member of the Young Lord Party, and so we're happy to have him. I don't recognize anyone else who is here as of yet, but we are expecting Monami Malik to talk about immigration. She is with DRUM, and that's going to be very interesting because they have just launched a special project, an initiative of they pulled together an international delegation for a visit to the Mexico-U.S. border and what is happening there. And she's also going to critique immigration under the Obama administration. And as we know, over 1 million people, undocumented workers and persons here in the U.S. have been deported under the Obama administration. So we are going to start our program off with Glenn Ford, as I said earlier, and he is going to give us a general overview of the international wars against Africa and African people worldwide. And let's give a round of applause for Glenn Ford.
Thank you, Nellie. Good afternoon. As she said, I'm going to speak generally about the subject. We build it as talk about the imperialist wars against Africa and African people worldwide. We also at Black is Back refer to that as the struggle to draw attention to the other wars. And those are the wars that many non-black activists in the US and in Europe pretend are not really wars at all. The wars against Somalia, the war against Congo and Haiti, the war against the black people of Colombia, these are just some of the many imperialist wars that are being waged around the world, but often do not rate even a mention as a war by much of the left. And of course, almost all of these other wars are against people of color. So we at the Black is Back Coalition said, if we can't even agree on what is a war and who the casualties of war are, then how can we forge a united anti-war movement? In other words, solidarity for what? What is the basis of solidarity in an anti-war movement when only one side gets to decide which struggles are worthy of attention, which places fit into the anti-war scheme of things, and which conflicts are just sad little stories of suffering but are not really wars? Wars are only worthy of the anti-war movement's attention, and I'm talking about the traditional anti-war movement, if they cost American lives or if they are too expensive for the American budget. If that's the case, then President Obama is right. What the US is doing in Libya is not a war because Americans are not being killed. And if the Americans and the Europeans can finish off Colonel Gaddafi very quickly, it won't cost that much in monetary terms to the United States either. Therefore, no dead Americans, no big tax burden, no war. Despite the fact that the US is causing the deaths of thousands of people, both civilians and soldiers, and despite the fact that the US and the Europeans are stealing from the Libyan people by armed aggression their most valuable possession, which is their sovereignty and their independence, but still it's not recognized, at least by President Obama, as a war. The Geneva Convention considers that aggressive war is the most serious crime that a nation can commit, and the theft of a people's sovereignty is a form of war, whatever the means of coercion, whether it be military or economic or some other insidious means. So we see that calling wars by their real name is of paramount importance. When you fail to call a crime by its name, you are denying the essence of the crime. If a woman is sexually assaulted, she doesn't call 911 and tell the police that she's had a very unpleasant experience with a rather nasty man. She says, "I've been raped." Hopefully, if the response is powerful and forceful enough, then we will have justice done in the case of the woman who was raped. But if she does not cry out rape, then one cannot expect that she will be treated as the victim of a rape. And if her neighbors and her friends don't treat it as a rape, then they have failed her utterly. But when Somalia was invaded by the US proxy, Ethiopia, in 2006, the US anti-war movement did not cry out, "Unjust invasion of Somalia by the United States." But it was an American war. The American fleet was operating off of Somalia's shores. The US aircraft were supporting Ethiopian troops on the battlefield. US advisors were with the Ethiopian units down to the company level. US special forces operated independently of the Ethiopians in Somalia, and they were picking their own targets. US intelligence and drone aircraft guided the Ethiopians in battle, and US money financed the entire operation. So yes, this was an American war. It's been an American war since at least 2006. And yet few in the US anti-war movement recognize this as an American war. They certainly did not act as if the United States was at war with Somalia. Almost immediately after the invasion, Somalia was plunged into what the United Nations called the worst humanitarian crisis in Africa, a crisis that was worse than Darfur, which we heard a great deal about. Millions were displaced and untold tens of thousands died. People from the same groups that are dying by the tens of thousands from the combined effects of drought and war today. That war set up Somalia for two huge humanitarian crises in just 4 years. And it was a U.S. war, but there was very little response from the traditional anti-war movement in the United States. Calling a war by its name and naming the perpetrators of that war has vast consequences for the lives of millions of people. So this is not a semantic exercise defining war. It's really of life and death consequence to millions. Congo was invaded by the armies of America's fastest black allies in Africa, Rwanda and Uganda. These are U.S. client states. They are armed to the teeth by the Americans, and they act as mercenaries for the United States all over Africa. And that also includes the country of Burundi. Uganda and Rwanda effectively seized control of Congo's mineral-rich northeast region, and they took their cut of those precious minerals and then kept the rest flowing to multinational corporations, including many U.S. corporations. All the while, millions of people are dying. The unbelievable carnage in the Congo is inconceivable absent the guiding hand of the United States, whose policy in Africa for the last 50 years has been to impose chaos wherever it cannot directly rule through one of its dictators, such as Mobutu. Even the United Nations last year issued a report that implicated those two U.S. client states, Rwanda and Uganda, in the mass deaths in Congo. But even in anti-war circles in the United States, you still, for the most part, do not hear Congo referred to as a U.S. crime or as a U.S. war, or as a war of any kind. It's seen as just another African tragedy, with black people killing other black people for no apparent reason. And therefore, there was virtually no response from the anti-war movement. We have witnessed the biggest death toll on earth in the Congo, the biggest death toll since World War II. And the superpower that benefits most from that genocide is left blameless, including by many on the left. This is why the Black Is Back Coalition has focused on these other wars waged by U.S. imperialism. It is these other wars that exact the highest price on human lives, yet they are treated as some kind of background noise to the real wars, the wars in which American lives and billions in tax dollars or obvious strategic assets like oil are involved. Black folks can die by the millions, and barely a whisper comes from the traditional anti-war movement. There should be no confusion and no ambiguity about the situation of Haiti. Haiti is the victim of armed U.S. aggression, the rape of her nationhood, and the massacre of her people. The facts are very straightforward. There should be no ambiguity. From economic strangulation to arming of the rebels in sanctuaries in the Dominican Republic, to direct invasion by U.S. troops in 2004, to an occupation overseen by the Americans and the French and the Canadians, the rape of Haiti took place in the full light of day. But who cried out rape here in the United States? As a consequence, Haiti has been made into a model of how 21st century imperialism reimposes colonialism throughout the world. It does so through the United Nations or through multilateral arrangements that claim the legitimacy of the so-called international community. That is the model that will be imposed on Libya if the U.S. and its allies are successful. The United States wages wars, economic wars, military wars, direct wars, proxy wars, all the while denying that hostilities exist. This is war by denial. And to the extent that anti-imperialist forces don't call the war by its name, call it war, and don't mobilize against it, the imperialists will succeed. In the aftermath of the overthrow of Aristide's government in Haiti, 5,000 Haitians were slaughtered. That is about the same number of U.S., total U.S. military deaths during the entire course of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, about 5,000. The little country of Haiti suffered as many deaths in a few months following the 2000 U.S. war against Haiti as the Americans have suffered in 10 years of two wars in Asia. Yet Haiti is not considered to be an American war. Colombia is the main U.S. ally in Latin America, and it wages war against its own people on behalf of U.S. corporations and on behalf of the U.S. military as an extension of the U.S. military. Colombia is an American base, and it's among the top three recipients of U.S. funding in the world. Whatever the Colombian regime and its paramilitaries do to the people of Colombia is on America's watch and America's responsibility as well. Colombia also has the distinction of displacing more of its people than any other country in the world. About 5 million displaced persons, the overwhelming majority of them Black Colombians and indigenous people. There's another prolonged displacement catastrophe that affects millions, and that's in Iraq. But that displacement catastrophe is recognized as a consequence of a U.S. war. Even Washington sometimes makes little noises about having some kind of moral responsibility in Iraq. But it does not recognize any responsibility for the Black and Native people of Colombia, because that is not recognized as a U.S. war. It's just Latin Americans killing each other through no fault of the United States. And so now we come to the war here at home. Now, when Black folks say that we are being waged war against here at home, it's very common for some white people on the left to refuse to take us seriously, refuse to take us literally. They basically say, well, you know, they're kind of prone to hyperbole. They exaggerate for effect. They want to get that call response thing going. They like drama. But we are deadly serious about saying that the United States is waging war against Black people here at home. There is a war against Black folks. And in some ways, that war is escalating. And the proof is in the numbers of prisoners that have been taken in that war. If one out of every eight prison inmates on planet Earth is an African American, there has to be a war, and it has to be a major war with piling up of all those prisoners and all those concentration camps that we call prisons. And if you don't realize that a war is going on, well, that is very sad. Because the people who are making war on you know exactly what they are doing. They didn't build all of this militarized police forces and prison complexes just for a scuffle. They built it for a long war. They have the logistics, the personnel, the weapons, and it's all in the full light of day. So, of course, we're in a war. The slave trade was a war on Africa. The U.S. slave system was institutionalized warfare. The South damn near won the Civil War because their soldiers were veterans of constant white militia patrols against slave insurrections. They were veterans already. The crushing of Reconstruction was an act of war, or a chapter in an ongoing war, because white militia reinstated white rule at the point of a gun. Jim Crow was enforced by terror. That's race war. And when we finally broke the back of the old Jim Crow, they introduced a new war strategy of mass black incarceration. The government's COINTEL program was an assault on black leadership, but as many others have said, mass black incarceration is a counterinsurgency war strategy. It is directed against a whole people. And it doesn't matter whether we are in a state of insurrection or not, it is a preemptive counterinsurgency, and it does not abate no matter what we do. The question, therefore, is not whether we are at war, it is when did the war stop? From slavery to today, the war has never ended. In the same way, the 500-year war of Europe against the rest of the world has never stopped. From 1492 onward, a small slice of humanity has waged constant wars against the rest of the Earth's population, an endless war of subjugation, and it hasn't stopped. Just ask the people of Libya. We are now, I believe, in the last stages of that 500-year war. We call it the battle against U.S. imperialism. And I believe that U.S. imperialism is engaged in its final offensive. They're engaged in a frenzy of military base building, unprecedented even for the United States post-World War II. U.S. special forces have exploded, and some are calling special operations the new independent branch of the U.S. military. The U.S. is fielding drones as quickly as it can build them. President Obama has vastly increased the capability of the United States to conduct many small wars simultaneously, and it is using that capability. That means that the number of other wars, the wars that much of the left has refused to recognize in the past, the number of other wars will proliferate. In fact, I believe that the character of the struggle against U.S. imperialism will be defined by these other wars, which is why the Black Is Back Coalition has pressed so hard on this issue. We will be of very little use to the people of the world or to ourselves if we fail to even recognize these imperial assaults as wars. Power to the people. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Glenn Ford. Very powerful presentation. I did neglect to say our other guest speaker here, and we welcome her from Connecticut, is Chris Gavreau, who is with the United National Anti-War Coalition. And I think, given Glenn's presentation, it is appropriate to ask her to come and talk with us about why it is that the anti-war movement can no longer ignore the wars against African people worldwide, and Africa as well. Chris Gavreau.
Two days ago, I sat at a forum in Connecticut addressed by the lawyer who's defending Tonya McDowell. I don't know if you know who Tonya McDowell is, but she's a homeless mother who's facing 20 years in prison for, quote, stealing $40,000 worth of education because she enrolled her kindergarten-age son in the Norwalk City Schools when her last known address and her van was parked in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Now, she was found out by a public housing inspector at first, who went to the police and said that a crime was being committed because her son was staying in public housing with a friend. Today, she's in jail on $250,000 bond. And if a massive defense campaign does not free her, this woman, who was refused a job on the outside and had to live in her van, may end up in prison. And in that prison, if we're to believe the Nation muckraking reporter published 2 weeks ago, she may end up making aircraft engine parts that result in a hefty profit for a private military contractor who's exploiting her as a modern-day industrial slave. Those parts will then end up in the machinery of the ever-expanding U.S. military operations abroad described by Glenn. Operations that include the horrors in Libya, the torture chambers in Somalia, the epidemics in Haiti, and the deadly special ops all over the world. The United National Anti-War Coalition, like other groups in the peace and social justice movement, thinks, and I have to say, thanks in great measure to the patience and diligence of the leaders of Black is Back, have begun to wake up to the reality of the prison industrial complex and the place of mass incarceration in the U.S. system of racial control and repression. And we've woken up to see more clearly the place that the new Jim Crow has in the overall effort of the U.S. government to construct a repressive apparatus that would preclude any real fight against the wars at home and the wars abroad. The spell that was created by the government's deliberate criminalization of an entire community has been partially broken. And today, even those who have been ignorant of the ways of the system can see this more clearly. They can see the ways that the U.S. wars in the Middle East and South Asia, the new scramble for Africa, the so-called drug war on the U.S.-Mexico border and now with U.S. Military operatives inside sovereign Mexico, the way all these are tied to the wars on the Black community and working people here at home. Conversely, I should say more optimistically, we all saw the raw social power that was manifested in London when Black, Asian, and Anglo youth mocked and defied the police state in the streets. Like all of you, we watched again and again the YouTube video of the Woolwich Arsenal youth testing their strength against the institutions that were destroying their lives. Who could watch that video and not think of the Battle of the Cairo Bridge and imagine the day when the exploited and oppressed in the U.S. are strong enough to win social justice in the streets here? Suffice it to say that we understand that a U.S.-based anti-war movement that is cut off from the struggles in the Black community is, by its very nature, too weak to win. We understand that an effective anti-war movement will link the wars abroad and the wars at home, and help all those victimized by such wars to find a way to march together in the streets. We hope that our expression of solidarity with Black is Back puts us here today a few steps on the path toward the kind of collaboration that can give the Pentagon and AFRICOM, ICE, and Homeland Security, and all the other institutions implementing these wars a run for their money. I ask you to consider the possibility next spring, when approximately 10,000 leaders of two of the most destructive institutions of the corporate elite on this planet will converge in Chicago, Illinois. The White House has announced that it's hosting then thousands of military and civilian representatives of the 28-nation, U.S.-commanded, Libya war-making North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, and at the same time, a meeting of the G8, an association of the richest nations on Earth, an association that uses NATO and the IMF and the World Bank and other financial institutions to force Africa, Asia, Latin America, and even Southern Europe to open up their countries to ever greater exploitation by international corporations and to implement ever greater austerity measures on their already miserable populations. Who can fail to understand today that the G8 corporate elites will spare no cost, will spare no blood, to attempt to recover a rate of profit that they once enjoyed in the post-World War II era boom? The new scramble for Africa stands, like the intervention in the Middle East, front and center in their game plan. We watch as the EU bankers dictate the economic programs and austerity measures that must be undertaken in the once sovereign nations of Greece and Italy, right in the heart of Europe. Doesn't take a lot of imagination and very little research to understand that their goals and the brutality with which they will fight for these economic policies and austerity measures on the African continent, the depth of those, even though they'll be extracted more quietly than from those vulnerable nations if we rely on U.S. media for that information. I recently read that the rate of return in the 1990s on direct foreign investment in Africa was 16% higher than would be returned from investments in the capitalist centers. And this process continues in ever expanding waves. Just last week, the head of the UK traveled to South Africa and Nigeria to facilitate ever more destructive trade rules in nation after nation, so that the US and other G8 countries, like other G8 countries, they could be poised to better exploit Africa's long undervalued energy resources, mineral resources, and now, of course, even land grabbed up for biofuel production. Or, as in the Horn of Africa and Yemen, to control the sea lanes through which their potential profitable exports must travel. At home, they fight to eliminate the social wage entirely, to destroy the unions, to terrorize the Latino community with nearly 500,000 deportations a year, to terrorize the Muslim American community with high-profile preemptive prosecutions that have put maybe 700 in special private CMUs, or communication management units, or solitary confinement reaches the legal definition of torture. And of course, the mass incarceration of black youth, rendering them disenfranchised and often nearly unemployable. And of course, this plan, with different variations, is being carried out in every country in the world. All of this to create the most docile, the most easy to exploit workforce imaginable, and to take more of our nickels and dimes to enrich their coffers through legal, tax, and other measures. I think every day we see a new connection. Yesterday it was announced that Verizon Phone Company was hiring Blackwater mercenaries, the same mercenaries who served in Afghanistan and Iraq and in New Orleans to deal with Verizon picket lines in the Northeast. Now, United National Anti-War Committee was founded on a pretty simple idea that the only social movements that history tells us that only social movements that are independent of the Democratic and Republican parties, that rely on the mass action of millions of working people, can be counted on, can be effective in responding to the kind of brutality that we're facing today. And that is the kind of movement that we hope to rebuild. We think that we can take a major step forward this spring when the whole world will be watching Chicago and waiting to see if people in the US will mount a challenge to this cabal of the real looters of this planet. Our goal is peaceful, legal, massive marches on March 15th, the opening day of the G8 and NATO summits. And on Saturday, May 19th, we want peaceful legal marches that can be attended by large numbers of folks from the black, from the immigrant, from the Muslim American, from the Palestinian community, folks under the surveillance and constant pressure from the repressive powers in this country. We want to launch a year-long civil liberties campaign that will make it possible for us to get that space, to get that political space, so that this kind of march, which will have representatives from Canada, from Mexico, from Europe, will truly be an international response to the international gathering of the war makers, can be successful. And we want to, we appeal to you today to become part of the leadership of that effort, to become part of 11 months of political pressure and struggle to win one for civil liberties in the midst of this growing repression, to find the space for that demonstration, to win the right of our international co-thinkers and colleagues and comrades and friends to come and be part of that protest in Chicago. And I ask you all to imagine the political power of a massive demonstration in that space that's visible to the whole world, that says when NATO and G8 is the only thing on the news, that we will, we will fight to struggle together against the US-run NATO and G8 organizations. The demands for the action are to bring all US-NATO troops, mercenaries, and war contractors home now from Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, Libya, the Middle East, and elsewhere, to end US aid to Israel, to end the siege of Gaza, to allocate trillions for jobs, housing, education, pensions, and the environment, no to the attacks on the unions, bring the war dollars home, and as the statement that I passed out, which was the result of some discussion and development inside UNAC, to stop the US-NATO bombing of Libya, call for US hands-off Africa, to end the US-UN occupation of Haiti, and money for jobs and education, not for war and incarceration. If you have friends in Chicago, there'll be a major national meeting next weekend, and we hope that Black is Back will take its place in the leadership of this struggle. And I thank you again for allowing me to express my solidarity here today.
Thank you very much, Chris. At this time, I'm going to introduce my co-moderator. This is Brother Leroy Baylor. He is the host and producer of The Communicators and a number of other shows. On WHCR Radio, that's 90.3 FM on your dial, the voice of Harlem Radio, and we are happy to have him here with us today, and he's going to introduce our next speaker, Mr. Sales.
Thank you, Sister Nelly, and before I introduce my brother, I just want to say to us here that coming out on a Saturday afternoon, whether it's as a student or whether it's as a teacher, is a very noble effort because most of us are doing something that we need a break for on a Saturday. But to come out on a Saturday afternoon for a teach-in is indeed an honor for all of us. An honor because the ideas that are exchanged in a teach-in can only sharpen us. There is an obligation that goes along with understanding or getting knowledge, and that obligation is to spread the information that we gain. So I would encourage us all that upon leaving the teach-in today, that we plan to do a 5-point summary that we can put into an email, send to our own email list as to what you got today, and that way begin to spread the news and information that we gain from this teach-in. Black is Back Coalition, I'm very happy and honored to have been invited to be a part of this teach-in by way of the Black is Back Coalition. It is historically a fact that the major movements in America have come as a result of Black people being awakened to who they are and to the need to protest, and that in turn has given the rest of us, quote, Americans, end quote, the courage to do what we have to do to support our own particular causes. So those of us who are in the room in coalition and unity with one another should always, regardless of what our background is, encourage Black people to be conscious of what they have been exposed to in America, and that the soul and the rhythm of movements in the past can be continued in the present. The brother who is about to speak is a young man who has been at the forefront of motivating other people by his words, by his courage, and also by his diligent scholarship. Scholarship is one thing when you write and you are in a university and you just leave, you know, you write for a journal. If you get in, if you get tenure, that's great. That's the majority of the people that I know who are scholars. But there are these other individuals who not only do the scholarly work in support of the effort that they do in a classroom, but they also come into the community. They're present. They say, you wind up saying, oh, you're so-and-so? They say, yeah, I'm so. You wrote that article in the journal, that's your book? Yeah, that's me. Wow, you here? Yeah, I'm here. So the brother, his value is not only his scholarship, but he causes and prompts his students to study. When you study, you get, that's what sharpens your critical thinking. You look at things from a number of angles, as opposed to doing a homework task. This man, he in his classroom motivates individuals. He stimulates individuals to go deep into the subject, and he has done that in the community organizing that I've been exposed to him with, going back to tenant organizing here on Adam Clayton Powell Boulevard. I'm very happy to introduce a brother that not only talks the talk, but he walks it, and not only that, but his children, they got heart. They got some real good heart and they got smarts. Brother Bill Sales.
Well, it's always nice to find out that people feel like that about you, but it also makes you kind of nervous because it sets a very high standard, and I just hope my comments live up to the billing. Why should African Americans not support U.S. wars? Doesn't the country reward our patriotism with jobs and advances in civil rights? Doesn't our involvement in America's wars garner greater respect and acceptance of black folks at home? Isn't the military offering excellent educational and economic incentives to poor black folks? Isn't the U.S. military a force for good in the world? You saw that commercial, haven't you? I'd like to ask an additional question. How does the so-called war against terrorism advance the struggle against racism, imperialism, gender equality for the liberation of African Americans and all oppressed people? Of all these questions I've asked initially, how do we get the right answers? Well, you can't look to the corporate-dominated evening news for the answer, nor can you look to the political leadership in the United States, whether Democrat or Republican. Even if that leadership is composed of African Americans like Barack Obama, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, or Susan Rice, we shouldn't go for the Madison Avenue hype. Rather, I would suggest that a starting point would be the advice of those black leaders who stood the test of time. Over a century ago in 1852, the greatest black leader to struggle against slavery intoned in relationship to the 4th of July that the behavior of the young American nation would disgrace a nation of savages. Of course, that was Frederick Douglass. He would later go on to join with the black nationalist abolitionist Henry Highland Garnett. And in 1879, they both spoke against the imperial domination of Cuba, whether in the hands of the Spanish or the Americans. They supported liberation for Cuba as a nation of African people. Somewhat later in 1915, Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois correctly situated Africa in the genesis of racism, imperialism, and what was then called the Great War. At that time, in a very, very important article in Atlantic Monthly called The African Roots of the Coming World War, he said, and I'll just quote him briefly, "In a very real sense, Africa is a prime cause of this terrible overturning of civilization," Dr. Du Bois said. "In the dark continent are hidden the roots, not simply of war today, but of the menace of wars tomorrow. The present world war is then the result of jealousies engendered by the recent rise of armed national associations of labor and capital, whose aim is the exploitation of the wealth of the world, mainly outside the European circle of nations. These associations, grown jealous and suspicious at the division of the spoils of trade empire, are fighting to enlarge their respective shares. They look for expansion, not in Europe, but in Asia, and particularly in Africa. That was Dr. Du Bois in 1915. The more things change, the more things remain the same, someone said. More than a century later, Dr. Martin Luther King took a principled stand against the war in Vietnam. He saw that war was as symptomatic as a malady within the American spirit. King indicted the United States government as the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today. During that same era, Malcolm X, in one of his most famous speeches, The Ballot of the Bullet, addressed the question of black citizenship and patriotism. And I'll quote him briefly. He said, "No, I'm not an American. I am one of the 22 million black people who are the victims of Americanism. One of the 22 million black people who are the victims of democracy, nothing but disguised hypocrisy. So I'm not standing here speaking to you as an American or a patriot or a flag saluter or a flag waver. No, not I. I'm speaking as a victim of this American system, and I see America through the eyes of the victim. I don't see an American dream. I see an American nightmare." End quote. Our historic icons are calling us through the ages. We must wake up. Black folks are being assailed around the world. We must recognize that we are at war, and our existence as a people and as a race is at stake. As we meet here today, the United States is at war in numerous countries. This is not a new phenomenon. War is inseparable from racism, capitalism, and imperialism. This becomes clear in any accurate analysis of the political economy of capitalism and its historic development. Since 1800, the United States has been at war 3 years for every 1 year it has been at peace. There has scarcely been a year of peace since the conclusion of the Vietnam War. Look at the record. In 1976, the United States openly backed a CIA initiative that supported the South African invasion of Angola. In the 1980s, U.S. forces fought in Lebanon. They later invaded the Caribbean nation of Grenada. And they ended the decade by launching an aggression against Panama and its elected president that led to the deaths of thousands of Afro-Panamanians. The 1990s, as we all know, saw U.S. forces fighting the Persian Gulf, in the former Yugoslavia, and in Somalia. Since October 2001, huge armies have taken the field in Central Asia and the Persian Gulf and initiated new involvements in Africa, in Somalia, and in Libya. A central prop of imperialist domination in Haiti has been the presence of U.S., French, and United Nations forces. Huge military outlays support the presence of U.S. troops in many countries under the false rubric of the war against drugs. In that regard, literally billions of dollars have been swallowed up in Colombia, which in reality have been used against the indigenous peoples and in those areas of the country with large black populations. The Zionist state of Israel consumes billions of dollars in United States military aid each year, with which it brutalizes the Palestinians and in general serves as an American proxy in the Middle East. The total of American military bases in other people's countries was estimated in 2005 to be approximately 737. If this were an honest count, the actual size of our military empire would probably go up maybe past 1,000 different bases overseas. But no one, possibly not even the Pentagon, knows the exact number for sure. The United States military apparatus includes the major political partners in NATO. But the overwhelming bulk of NATO forces are United States units, and its command structure is dominated by American generals and admirals. NATO is an instrument of U.S. military domination. Together with mercenary military contractors and death squads operated out of various intelligence agencies and entities yet to be identified, the U.S. defense establishment is an unsupportable albatross upon which the human rights aspirations of the world are presently sinking. The fiscal 2010 Department of Defense budget was originally pegged at $680 billion, $16 billion more than Obama himself had requested. But an additional $37 billion supplemental budget to support the Iraq and Afghanistan wars were added in the spring of 2010. How big is this defense budget? Officially, it is 20% of the total American budget in the last fiscal year. But this official figure is a gross understatement. The discretionary portion of the budget is 19% of the total, but over half of that discretionary budget is composed of military spending. That brings the total of military spending up to around 30% or more. However, a significant portion of the budget is composed of debt retiring that is a result of past defense expenditures. Therefore, the total impact of the defense budget, past and present, on any annual budget today is well in excess of 40%. The last figures I looked at indicated that about 57% of tax revenues in any given fiscal year currently are devoted to defense expenditure. The establishment and expansion of capitalism would not have been possible without war and imperialism. In U.S. history, the militia in the colonial period was established to crush slave rebellions and support the seizure of Native American lands. This is why it was required that every white male own a rifle and be available for service. This is the deeper meaning of the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Out of that militia came the tradition of the standing army as an instrument of capitalist expansion. In the 19th century, military expansion consolidated American access to the Caribbean and the Pacific. As well, it secured a huge internal market from coast to coast. That century, that is the 19th century, saw U.S. forces engage in Africa, the Caribbean, in the Pacific, in Hawaii, Samoa, Indochina, China, and Korea. In addition to the two world wars of the first half of the 20th century, United States Marines over that same period in time have deposed and imposed presidents in and on Cuba, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic, among other places. Let me just give you a very brief summary of some of the interventions that characterized the 20th century in the Western Hemisphere. U.S. troops occupied areas of Mexico from 1914 to 1919. Haiti was continuously occupied by U.S. troops from 1915 to 1934. The Dominican Republic was likewise occupied continuously from 1916 to 1924. More recently, Juan Bosch was deposed as a legitimate contender for the presidency of the Dominican Republic by U.S. Marines, who came in April of 65 and stayed to September 1966. This method of intervening to depose legitimately elected leadership was replicated in 2004 in Haiti, when American forces were instrumental in removing President Bertrand Aristide from his constitutionally elected presidency in Haiti. And when he woke up the next day, he was in the Central African Republic, if memory serves me correctly. And he wasn't able to return until last year. In the 21st century, American militarism in pursuit of capitalist and imperialist objectives has become more rabid. Despite the end of the Cold War, the United States wages resource wars for competitive advantage vis-a-vis her emerging challenger for world hegemony, China. These wars are focused on the resources of Central Asia, the Persian Gulf, and now Africa. War is a necessary condition for the continued existence of capitalism. The gigantic outlays on defense perform several necessary functions in the US economy. First, they provide the hardware and personnel for securing raw materials and resources in all areas of the world. Second, as a constituent of the military-industrial complex, defense expenditures counteract the pronounced tendency of late capitalism towards stagnation. Underutilized resources, unemployed personnel, and most importantly, otherwise idle financial capital are absorbed through huge defense expenditures and investment. Third, war creates a mindset of crisis which facilitates denial of civil rights and loss of respect for the human rights of others. It is in this context that we must understand the McCarthyism of the post-World War II period, Cold War period, and the contemporary Islamophobia of the war on terrorism. War is a precursor of racism and fascism at home as much as it is a consequence of it. Here in the United States, the military-industrial complex is at the heart of the financialization of the American economy. This financialization has produced ever-intensifying cycles of boom and bust over the last 30 years. The most recent downturn has destroyed the wealth that black people have accumulated since slavery. Wealth, even more than income equality, has become a characteristic feature of the political economy of late capitalism. Intensifying racism is another salient feature of this economy of unending war. The United States has failed in its efforts to lead the third world in its desire to develop and close the gap with the post-industrial nations. It has placed the blame on failed states and used their shortcomings as a rationale for supposed humanitarian intervention under the cover of the United Nations, or less plausibly, NATO. The targeted continent of this travesty is Africa. AFRICOM is the United States Regional Military Command for aggression against our motherland. The most advanced country in Africa is now being bombarded daily by her minions. AFRICOM troops and their African surrogates ravage Somalia and exacerbate the famine which has befallen that country. American surrogates in Rwanda, Burundi spread genocidal war and disorganization into the Eastern Congo. This guarantees that coltan and other strategic minerals remain available at rock bottom prices to American corporations. As oil reserves are discovered in Uganda, AFRICOM consolidates its presence in that country and props up an unpopular dictator. The expansion of AFRICOM has occurred on Obama's watch. If the interventions in Somalia and Libya are successful, will AFRICOM venture a direct intervention into Zimbabwe? It is crucially important to understand if racist imperialists can run rampant in the motherland and in countries everywhere with large black populations, the African race will not be respected anywhere. Such impunity reinforces racist stereotypes and the sense of white skin privilege. It makes it that much harder for our people here to be respected when applying for a job, looking for decent housing, or insisting on an adequate education for our children, among other things. After World War II, the international community had outlawed war as an instrument of national policy. The neoconservative blueprint, Project for a New American Century, re-legitimized war as an instrument for worldwide imperialist domination. Drafted in 1992 and becoming state policy openly within the Bush administration, but with antecedents in the Clinton White House, this blueprint represented a return to 19th century racist notions of manifest destiny. It argues that in a post-Cold War world, the only superpower, the United States, should use its military hegemony aggressively to establish everywhere Western liberal democracy and free enterprise capitalism. It had advanced an ideological offensive, the notion of a clash of civilizations. It is based this notion on the 19th century Eurocentric belief that the fundamental values and achievements of humanity are indelibly associated with Western civilization. Through military might and economic intimidation, it attempts to impose a single model of societal development upon the developing nations. This model, called the neoliberal paradigm, is based on a false assumption or false conception of the political, economic, and social history of Euro-American nations. Its military aspect, imperialist war, has revealed the impotence of American military might. Its political project, multi-party democracy and free elections, has been a tool for the massive intervention of the West in the internal affairs of developing countries. Its economic aspect, structural adjustment programs under the aegis of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, have promoted economic disasters on a world scale. Ironically, this project has found its most intense and profound expression in the Obama administration. A close inspection of the record of his administration, however, reveals this man, Obama, as a false promise, and the truth is not in him. The need to vicariously transcend racism by defending this agent of racist imperial domination will have the same impact on our people as an overdose of narcotics. If we don't overcome the lure of the black president, we as a people will not survive. The failure of the project for a new American century and its notion of full spectrum dominance have created an opportunity for the victims of democracy to initiate a new phase in the struggle for black liberation. Like all historical windows of opportunity, this window will not stay open forever. Imperialist war always exposes its own weaknesses and thus gives us opportunity to fight back. However, if these opportunities are not exploited, the system of imperialism will reorganize and strengthen itself. There is nothing inevitable about the demise of racism, monopoly, capitalism, and imperialism. Whether they are defeated or not depends on us. We have the ability to be the agents of societal transformation, but we have to see that mission and embrace it. This is the deeper meaning of Fanon's dictum that every generation rises from relative obscurity and either fulfills its historic mission or betrays it. The Black is Back Coalition should be commended for this teaching and for its larger anti-war initiative, calling us back to the struggle against war and racism and imperialism. Let us go forward to fulfill our historic mission and bring this mother down.
Bill says, he's a scholar and he drops in the street thing at the end. Get busy. Ladies and gentlemen, events like this are labors of love and labors of dedication. And to move on to the next one is to provide for this one. The donation suggested was suggested, whatever you can do, there's going to be a basket going around now. Sister Nellie Bailey, one of the organizers of this teach-in, is going to be seeing you very soon. Whatever you can contribute is appreciated. And for those of us who got here already, got here late, whatever you can do is appreciated. It leads to doing flyers for the next one, and getting videotapes and paying for a photographer, film development, etc. And once again, it's an honor to be here for a teaching, whenever you hear about a teaching, whether it's in an institution, a school, a college, a university, or in a church setting such as this, I would advise all of us to advise someone else, you're gonna be at a teaching. But advise others, hey, look, man, you'll never know what you can learn. Just spend a half hour, an hour. And Bill dropped some concepts. I want to make sure that I got it right, Bill. You dropped a concept. You said, I'm paraphrasing, if Africa becomes a pushover for Western nations, that's going to lead to the gross, when I say gross, the massive, the universal disrespect of black people. That you said that in effect. And that for me is a new concept. That's one of those awakening, oh yeah, I never thought about that. And that's how somebody in your family is a pushover. And you go out to the corner store and somebody's snatching you by the collar. So supporting the effort, and I pause for a moment because a lot of times, Brother Bill and the audience, we have, here in America, we have fought for the freedom, justice, and equality of other peoples, and they not on the scene. But then again, they pick up. Sometimes they're afraid to come. But they'll pick up on a message that they will get from a meeting such as this, or writings, or articles, and they in turn, years hence, will say, I read such and such in such and such journal, and if I didn't read that, I wouldn't have been as sharp as I am. I'm talking about our brothers and sisters who are overseas and maybe not at this meeting. So it's never without being watched or picked up on that our efforts to drop information and knowledge never goes for naught. It never goes for naught. And even if you're in a church or in another setting where it's just one of you and about five people in the audience, it never goes without a payoff. We always have to keep preaching and teaching, regardless of whether it's the choir or new people who come into our orbit. And our next guest is a young man who has been well skilled in going after information. And I've never interviewed this brother before. I interview a lot of people on the radio show that I do, but I've never had the benefit of interviewing this brother, but I've heard him on WLIB in the evening, and he takes a very interesting positions from time to time. And what they do on LIB on Sunday nights at about 8 o'clock, Gary Bird has a panel of individuals who come forth and they dialogue back and forth. And I don't necessarily agree with this point, that point, or another, but I listen every Sunday night. And I want to salute this brother for starting a paper that has the name of a Garvey initiative, and for being bold in putting out information that others have not bothered to put out. And he has it on the current front page of the Black Star News, and that is the ethnic cleansing that's going on in Libya that's not talked about by anyone. And it hurts me as a person in communications that there are not enough black people, I'm talking about black people who are in a position to take up issues that are, quote, safe, that they don't even take up. Maybe they don't read. But without further ado, he's a student of journalism. He practices what he preaches. He puts out his own paper. He ain't waiting for the New York Times to pick him up for a Sunday magazine article, Milton Altomati.
Greetings, sisters and brothers. It's a beautiful day outside, but it's much more beautiful inside here today, because we're here to exchange knowledge and hopefully to gain some knowledge from each other. First, a quick correction. In terms of the show with Gary Bird, it's actually at 9 p.m. on Sundays. I've been told I have 12 minutes. I would like to donate my first minute to Brother Gil Noble. Yes, go ahead. This is a brother who is dedicated to speaking truth to power. He's been doing so for almost 40 years. He could have been a self-serving person who, once the door was open, he could have promoted his own personal career and elevated himself in this corporate media world and enriched himself and become a media star. But he made a deliberate choice to deliver the kind of information that we actually need much more of, as all the evidence of contemporary events proves. So let's give him another round of applause. Now let's pray for his health. Let's pray for his recovery. Let's pray for his family, regardless of what God that you pray to or the Creator. Pray for Brother Gil Noble. In Africa, we are now witnessing Kwame Nkrumah's worst fears when he said in the late 1950s, in the 1960s, after Ghana's independence, that without African unity, without the formation of a single unified African government and African continental army, Africa would not be able to protect its independence. And that's the most vivid example of his fears is what we are now witnessing in Libya. But also, perhaps we should take some heart that sometimes in so-called defeat actually also lays future spectacular victories. Let's remember 1895, when Italy invaded and occupied Ethiopia, commonly referred to as Abyssinia in those days. And when I was doing research that eventually provided material for my book, The Hearts of Darkness, How Western Writers Created the Racist Image of Africa, one of the headlines I encountered from a New York Times article from that era was, Italy's spectacular victory that all the tribes of Ethiopia were welcoming the Italians, who are now going to bring civilization and commerce to Abyssinia and show them modern means of production and communication and exchange, which would be best for the whole world and for the civilized countries. That was then. In 1896, at the Great Battle of Adowa, when under Menelik, the Ethiopians destroyed the Italian army. Yes, go ahead. At that time, the headline changed. The headline was not Ethiopia's great defeat. It was Italy's terrible defeat. And what did the article say? That it was due to the incompetence of the Italian general, Barratieri, that they were actually overwhelmed and defeated by this savage army with their inferior weapons. No, it was because the Ethiopians were fighting for their land and for their country, and they had the heart, the courage, and the mission to defeat that army and capture almost 5,000 soldiers. Over an army of 10,000 invaders was completely destroyed. And I remember one of the headlines in the article in the New York Times said, Rome is now shaken up. The Pope canceled a great dinner. And the government of the day in Rome collapsed. And now the fear was this. Would the Ethiopians decide to pursue the Italians all the way to Europe? Of course, that was the worst fears, an invading army from the African continent coming to occupy Europe. So, is there some payback today? Who knows? Is Africa potentially squandering another Adowa moment, an opportunity? You must wonder, what could al-Qaddafi be thinking today as the bandits supported by NATO near Tripoli? Is he asking himself, I dedicated most of this revolution to identifying with Africa, with the African continent, the African people. I invested perhaps $100 billion of resources of Libya, the rest of the continent. I have withstood the armies of the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, you name it, the NATO countries, for 6 months with merciless 24/7 bombardment. Imagine if maybe only a handful of African countries, four or five, were able to come forward and say an invasion of an African country is an invasion of the entire continent, and we will stand with you, and we will not allow NATO to install a puppet regime. I would be thinking the same thing if I were in his shoes. Will Africa deliver in the next few days, in the next few weeks? The opportunity has been there for 6 months. When we look back, sometimes we say, what was wrong with those so-called chiefs in the era of European colonial penetration on the continent? How could they sign those so-called agreements with the Europeans that formalized and legitimized the colonization of those African countries? What was wrong with them? Well, those ancestors must be looking down and say, what was wrong with Nigeria? What was wrong with South Africa when they voted for resolution 1973 at the United Nations? What is the difference between what they did today and what those so-called chiefs did to legitimize colonial rule in Africa? I see no difference. To his credit, at least, Jacob Zuma, the president of South Africa, has been giving some effort and, in fact, succeeded in coming up with an African peace plan. The peace plan, which disproves all these lies about the intentions behind the Western invasion of Libya. The peace plan includes a ceasefire, the creation of a humanitarian corridor to provide relief to all the victims of this war of aggression. It calls for negotiation among all Libyans to create a constitution. It calls for national elections that all Libyans would be eligible to participate in. In fact, the so-called rebels in Benghazi had accepted this proposal because some of them may indeed be feeling the pain of the destruction of their country. But they were overruled and told nonsense by Washington, by London and Paris, because they're not interested in peace in Libya. France, one of the prime architects of this war of aggression, Sarkozy, is trying to convince us that he's trying to save the lives of civilians in Libya. He cares so much about North Africans. He cares so much about Africans. When in France, we know how Africans are treated. These things just don't reconcile. Perhaps it's because of the 44 billion barrels of known proven reserves of oil that Libya has, and the vast quantities of natural gas that Libya has. It's not even about speculation. Libya has so much wealth that if all the oil was sold today, each individual, the population is less than 7 million, each individual could get a check of almost $500,000. Household, each household might be able to get a check for $2 to $3 million. And what has the government done with the money? $30 billion to make the issue of water scarcity a history. One of the greatest man-made designed facilities to bring water from deep in the desert and share it not only with all Libyans, but with neighboring countries as well. I was in Libya in January. You would not believe the spectacular buildings, the roads, the bridges, while our own infrastructure is crumbling here in the United States. Healthcare, free education, free landline telephone. These were things that amazed me as I was learning more and more and talking to Libyans. And then you realize how warped our own thinking has become when you think that these things are natural, when in fact, these are the things that human beings all over the world should be entitled to. It's not speculation. If you look at the Financial Times, March 14, 2011, there's a front page story, an interview with Abdeljalil, who is the so-called leader of the Transitional National Council in Benghazi. He said, in a post-Qaddafi Libya, the oil concessions are going to be allotted and doled out to foreign countries depending on the level of support that they give us in getting rid of Qaddafi. They don't even hide it. It's out there. Obviously, it's not magnified. You need to research for this information. And let's examine the credentials of these so-called rebels. Another article in the Wall Street Journal, April 2nd, 2011. An interview with former Mujahideen that had been captured in Afghanistan. One was released to Libya. Al-Hadari is his name. The other, Ben Komo, was detained in Guantanamo Bay for about 6 years and then also released back to Qaddafi. And both of them were then released by Qaddafi in 2007. Where are they now? They are training these so-called rebels. So potentially, we are creating another Taliban moment here in Libya. What did al-Hadari say? He said, we hated the United States 100%, but today it's only 50%. I guess President Obama and Secretary Clinton have decided that they can work with this 50%. I'd like to focus my final remarks on this article that we published a few weeks ago on the front pages of the New York Times, of the Black Star News, and it refers to the ethnic cleansing in Misrata, which has been totally ignored by the New York Times. It was actually first reported in the Wall Street Journal, and I also strongly recommend that you look at this article, published June 21, 2011. And it says that in the city of Misrata, there's a brigade of the rebels that has renamed itself the Brigade for Purging Slaves, Black Skin. Now, why did this story not appear in the New York Times? For obvious reasons. Because if these so-called rebels are being sold to us as the saviors of Libya, providing the new dawn in Libya, these kind of stories would not reconcile with their true nature. The article reported that in one section of the city of Misurata, where 4/5 of the population had been black Libyans, they had all completely disappeared. I would not be surprised if there are mass graves in Misurata. And the article also reported that there was a bounty, a reward on the heads of black people in Misurata. The article also reported that the so-called rebels said if they got to a nearby town called Tawega, 25 miles away, which was also predominantly black, they would do the same thing to them that they had done in Misurata, and said Tawega would be no more, they should pack and leave, and henceforth going forward, we don't want anybody identified with Tawega, and we don't want their children to go to school either. This goes beyond ethnic cleansing. This, in fact, is the definition of genocide. The article was not even mentioned in the New York Times or referred to in CNN, and nobody saw fit from the White House or the State Department to even say that, even though we support these so-called rebels. These atrocities must be condemned and must be investigated. Up to date, I submit that many people here were not even aware of this incident, which shows you the kind of media environment we live in. If the people that control the New York Times, in terms of determining what is newsworthy, what is worth writing an editorial about, if they were of African ancestry, do we really believe that? Wait, I might be wrong. I was about to say, do we believe that they would totally ignore this story? But then again, you never know. The fact that the NAACP, the fact that organizations like the Urban League, the fact that members of the Black Congressional Caucus have not deemed it fit to hold a press conference and denounce this incident, I just changed my views right here, standing here. I was about to say, if black folks control the editorial board of the New York Times, that massacre would not be ignored. But now I'm not absolutely certain that it would not be ignored. And it just reinforces what a dangerous environment we live in today. But these seemingly powerful entities can be challenged. For several weeks, I've been speaking about that incident and about the fact that the New York Times saw fit to ignore it. And every time I would say, call the New York Times, and I say it again today, 212-556-1234, and ask them, ask the foreign news editor, ask the publisher, how can you ignore a story about the ethnic cleansing of a whole people? How is it possible? And I wrote perhaps 20 editorials asking the same question. Last Saturday, finally, the New York Times wrote about it. And I would not be surprised if some of the encouragement came from my editorials, because some of the specific incidents I referred to in my editorial was also mentioned in the New York Times article. And finally, they also linked to the Wall Street Journal article that my editorial had linked to. So, okay, fine, maybe a month and a half later, the New York Times finally saw fit to get to it. Why? Because they know that at the end of the day, when people start doing the research, when the mass graves are discovered, they want to be in a position to say that no, at least we also wrote about it. Sisters and brothers, we live in difficult times. An earlier speaker spoke about the uprising in London. What did Prime Minister David Cameron say? He said it was because of bad parenting. No, do your Google search and you'll see that's exactly what he said. It's because parents don't know where their children are at night. That's what he said. But others know that there is a reckoning coming. I have a friend who's a trader on Wall Street, a very wealthy individual. No, don't get any ideas. He hasn't shared any of it with me, but he is very wealthy. And I had breakfast with him about 2 weeks ago on a Monday. And this is a very wealthy Wall Street investor speaking with me. He said, where are the stories? Who is going to be writing, and these are his words, the riots that eventually will start erupting on the streets of American cities? Why is he saying this? Because he's saying the wealth and income inequality cannot be sustained. And this is a person who knows, because what he says actually moves the market in terms of commodities. That's how in tune and involved he is on Wall Street. He said the day is coming. And when that day comes, how will they be able to control it? He's talking about the government, of course. He's saying, I don't believe, because I know they'll try to use the army, but I don't believe that black and Latino soldiers are going to turn their machine guns at black and Latino people in the urban areas. This is his fear, and he's convinced of that. And that's why it's not surprising when you start seeing people like Warren Buffett now writing op-ed pieces saying, yes, tax us more. Why? Because they're hoping to make a bargain. They know that the day of reckoning is coming. No, they know it. They know the script. They know the script. One final observation to let you know what a perverse environment, what a perverse country we live in. 14 million people unemployed. The market going, gyrating up and down. So-called debt ceiling crisis. What is all this nonsense? At the same time, all these corporations have record balances, record so-called profits. It doesn't reconcile. These companies have billions of dollars, trillions of dollars in cash, liquid assets they're sitting on. They would rather do that than create jobs. They have so much money that I read an article in the Wall Street Journal saying Bank of New York Mellon is now paying some of these companies to deposit monies in excess of $50 million. Instead of paying them interest, they're actually charging those companies money to take the deposits. Google it, read it yourself. This is like putting trillions of dollars in your mattress at home rather than creating jobs. So if anybody denies that the day of reckoning is coming, I'll leave it at that. Thank you, sisters and brothers.
Milton Altamati of Black Star News and WLIB, 9 p.m. Sunday evenings. Tune in. That's 1190 on the AM dial. And you will hear a panel. I no longer look at Meet the Press, Wall Street, whatever. I don't look at it. Every time I listen, they lying. I say, oh my God. And I want to thank Brother Milton. There's in a way, they have planned against American soldiers killing American people in the ghettos, in a way. And that's why they have a lot of foreign nationals either in the army or in the, what they call the private contractors. There's a movie, and I can't remember, I got a bootleg copy, so it didn't give the title on the front, but I looked at it. It's not a current movie, but it deals with a guy chasing down a story He chases down a story. He's got long hair. Oh man! But in it, there's a section in the movie, in the film, where they talk about the contracts for the private armies, the Blackwaters. And in the dialogue, the guy says, "Look, man," he's explaining to this reporter. He says, "Look, man, it's not about the wars overseas, man. It's about the contracts that they're going to get for within the U.S." The guy says, "Wow, he's a reporter and whatnot." But that's just the point that I would just add. There's a lot of movies that they come out that we get involved in from an entertainment standpoint, and they'll drop some very key information in it and keep on going. And that movie, I'm sorry, I can't remember the title of that movie, but our next guests are going to be introduced by Sister Nellie Bailey. There's a film that I'm going to be hosting the question and answer period tonight downtown. It's called Programming a Nation, and it's on mind control to an extent. It's on HARP, it's on what they call subliminal seduction, that sort of thing. Well, whether you go see the film or not, you can advise other people to go see it. I haven't seen it. I don't have any financial piece of it or anything like that. But it's always important that we key everybody that we can outside of our immediate social circle or conscience circle into pulling information that will bring us all to a higher level of understanding of what's going on. This teaching, once again, I'm very happy to have been a part of it. It reminded me when I came in of the proverb, iron sharpens iron. And you can only get a sharpening from the scholars and the reporters and the writers who have come forth and done their research and makes us think and look at subject matter from many, many different angles. And I want to salute them and ask you to applaud the ones who have been here thus far and the ones who are coming after this, which is going to be a short. So this is for the ones who presented and for the ones who are coming to present. God bless you all. Thank you very much. The film is at the Quad. The Quad is called Programming a Nation. I haven't seen it. I interviewed the filmmaker this past Monday. And any film like that that's going to help us go to another level of consciousness is something that we should be very watchful of and considerate of. Thank you very much. God bless you all. Sister Nellie.
Thank you, Leroy Baylor. Let me tell you, I saw the film last night, Programming a Nation. It is really something that I filmed that I would highly recommend. It doesn't answer, there were criticisms of the film, it doesn't answer everything, but certainly it's a start in the right direction with these subliminal messages. Many of it focus in on sex. It was quite a revelation. I just want to ask you this. Has this been a teach-in? Have you learned things that you had not heard before? Are you enjoying this? Did we move in the right direction to provide you with education and analysis? Not generally done. And we have an extra treat for you because we have a critique by a writer of the Harlem Million March that's going to be coming up, and you're going to want to stay around for that. Okay, we're going to move very quickly, and I want to thank everyone for what appears to be a generous donation, because Lord knows we certainly spend some money on food.